Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
What's interesting is the founders, H.O. and K., from the very beginning of the practice, had a very strong philosophy that the success and long-term success of the practice would be based in diversity. And so even in mid-century America at the time, they brought together architects, interior designers, landscape architects, urban designers, and graphic designers as well, with the concept that if you had the best professionals doing their part, you would get the best overall design. And that sense of diversity was not just in kind of the different professional roles, but they wanted a diversity also of building types. And ultimately, their goal was a diversity of geography and people as well. My name is Larry Malik. I'm the design principal of HOK in London and the founder of HOK's European practice.
You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week is the architect Larry Malik. Larry was born in St. Louis in the American Midwest. He later went on to study architecture at the University of Pennsylvania, being taught for a time by the hugely influential architect Louis Kahn. After university, it was in St. Louis that Larry started his own practice, just over the road from HOK, the practice formed by George Hellmuth, Guillaume Abatta, and George Casubam. Alongside his practice, Larry taught for a time at Washington University in St. Louis, teaching for a while alongside his good friend Neve Brown. But in 1988, Larry joined HOK, the office across the street, and then moved across the Atlantic to start HOK's European practice based in London. Under his leadership, the office has grown to over 130 people, partly growing organically, and in 1995 by incorporating the practice Cecil Denny Highton. HOK now has 24 studios across the US and Canada, as well as offices in Beijing, Hong Kong, Mumbai, Shanghai, Dubai, and of course in London, making it comfortably one of the world's 10 largest architecture firms. In this week's episode, we talk about many of the practice's most notable buildings in London, including the Francis Crick Institute, the world headquarters for Barclays Bank in Canary Wharf, and an early but influential project, St. Barnabas Church in Dulwich. But I started by asking Larry about the provenance of that accent.
Yeah, it is. It's a Middle West accent from the heart of America, from St. Louis, Missouri, on the Mississippi River.
Yeah, and you're from St.
Louis. Yeah, I was born and raised in St. Louis, famous for jazz music, Scott Joplin's home, all the Mississippi River boats, and more recently, Eero Saarinen's famous Gateway Arch, because St. Louis was the so-called gateway to the West. It was the first major city off the East Coast, really. Okay. Curiously as well, founded by French rather than English. And so St. Louis and New Orleans are the only kind of two cities where the French rather than the English founded them.
Yeah. Also home of HOK.
So yes, by, yeah.
Which is where your journey with HOK, your work with HOK started in working opposite HOK.
Yeah, it did. I was teaching at the university and I had a small practice of my own across the street from HOK.
Okay.
When was this?
What sort of period?
This would have been in the mid-80s.
Okay.
Mid-80s. And I knew H O and K. I knew George Hellmuth, the H. Socially, I knew Guillaume Abatta, the O, because he was frequently at the university and would be on design reviews and final juries, and so he knew my work through there. And George Kassebaum was a Board of Trustees member of the university, and at the time I was also professional advisor for architecture to the university. So I would meet George once a month and brief him on what was happening at the university, so that on the campus, so that he could then brief the board about it. So yes, it was the nature in those days. HOK employed about half the architects in St. Louis, so if you were an architect, you would know HOK.
But not a big city, really. Now 300,000 odd, but not.
It has a curious history because in 1900, St. Louis was the fourth largest city in America. Over a million people. So it's one of those Midwestern American cities that has had a slow but steady decline in population and importance, in a sense, for many years, although they're certainly trying to alter that and in recent years have had some success in urban renewal. And of course, HOK has been a part of that, as well as many of the major civic buildings built over the last 50 years.
So you talked about the university. Did you study in St. Louis?
No. I did my undergraduate and graduate work at the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
At the time, Lou Kahn was teaching there, and from everything that I could find out, it seemed to be perhaps the leading, or at least among the leading, universities for architecture. So, as I said, I did my undergraduate work there. I combined a degree in design of the environment along with another major in art and architectural history, and was invited to continue on to the graduate program, and that's what I did.
In architecture.
I ended up getting a Master's of Architecture from the university as well. Sadly, by that time, Lou Kahn had passed away, and so I never studied in his studio, but I went to his lectures, and that was always a kind of magical experience, because by that time he had some trouble or difficulty with his eyes, and so they would always dim the lights in the auditorium, and of course he had his slides of his buildings, but he spoke in an incredibly inspirational and almost mystical way about architecture, and I think one couldn't help but be really inspired by that.
Okay.
So, and interestingly, at both Penn and Washington University, when I was teaching there, there was a large contingent of British architects, and so almost as a premonition, perhaps, of my eventual move to London. I was taught by people like Sir Peter Shepherd from Shepherd Epstein. There was other architects like Neave Brown was a good friend of mine. I co-taught with Neave Brown, and so I already had a strong sense of kind of British architecture, and I knew before I ever came to London, I knew a lot of the buildings that were there.
And was there? I mean, there must have been a sense, kind of being taught by Louis Kahn, of something special, you know, at the time, you know, those universities, the kind of architecture, I guess, you know, the way it's taught is so much about the people doing the teaching and the inspiration there. Do you have a sense at the time that that was something special?
Yeah, I think we all felt that was, it was a special opportunity. The interesting thing about Penn at the time was that virtually the entire faculty were practicing architects, who would come two or three afternoons a week. And so the architecture, you had architectural theory and design, but it was being taught by people who every day were working
practicing with
clients and building buildings. And so you had a real sense of what I would call kind of the complete architect, that the architect was certainly a person who had to be creative, imaginative, and inspired, but equally that the architecture was a very serious professional activity
and a business,
the architecture wasn't completed until you built the building.
That bits of paper don't improve people's lives, maybe, but the real building does. And then, I guess, you know, kind of jumping back even further, kind of growing up in the Midwest, what was the kind of inspiration to become? I mean, so many people we speak to, parents are architects, you know.
It's a good question. I think when I was, I don't know, 5-6 years old, I collected model cars. I would build model cars, and I was really interested in the design of cars. But that interest, you know, changed to from the moving objects to stationary objects, and I think, you know, from certainly 6 or 7 years old, when people would ask, what do you want to be? I would say an architect. And in the last few years, I was cleaning out my mother's house. Mm-hmm. She had passed away, and found a box full of drawings of mine from when I was 9 or 10 years old. And I was fascinated to find that I was drawing plans and sections as well as elevations, even at that age. And I don't remember that, but there is the evidence of it.
It's clearly the proof.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there was some distant tie in that we, as a family, we ended up in St. Louis because in the 1840s, my great-great-grandfather came from Germany as a young man. He had apprenticed and become a master builder. And so the first thing that he ended up building was a chest, and put all of his tools in it, and sailed to America and settled in St. Louis, and actually built a considerable section of the city, south side of St. Louis. And it's funny, because when he arrived, he was a builder. By the time he died in 1892, the obituary in the newspaper refers to him as an architect and builder. But again, it was that sense of craft, of architecture being something that is ultimately is a very physical thing that involves not just concepts and ideas, but involves really creating something that is built to last.
Okay. And the move then back from, I mean, people sometimes when they fly the nest, you're off to Penn State, was it?
University
of Pennsylvania. What's you then decided to move back?
To St. Louis, Well, actually, what happened was I was back visiting on the holidays, and I was about to graduate, and my mother said, you know, you never even try to find a job here in St. Louis. So I said, well, all right, I'll look in the newspaper, and I opened up the paper, and they were advertising for architects, and so I went to an interview, and was hired, offered a job, and so.
But this wasn't at HOK.
This was not at HOK. This was a practice, small practice that principally did office buildings, but actually they brought me on to do the non-office buildings that had to be done. So, in the first year, I designed. I designed two restaurants, two residences, things like that. And then by the end of after 1 year there, I was approached by a friend of somebody in the practice at the university, and asked if I would be interested in coming and teaching at Washington U. And so that's what happened.
And so did you move then to Washington?
No, Washington U is in St. Louis.
Ah, okay. Yes. Right. Get my okay. So you taught.
It's very confusing because there's George Washington University in Washington. There's Washington University in St. Louis, and there's the University of Washington in Washington State.
Yeah. So named after the president rather than after the city.
Exactly.
And so you taught. Was it full time teaching? No, you were teaching and still practicing.
It was teaching and practice. And in fact, at the beginning, it was a dual appointment to teach and to write a new master plan for the university, which was incredible at the time to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
And so I did that, and then that became the appointment. It transferred into helping in the architect selections and developing briefs for the new buildings that would come out of the university right, master okay. plan. So
a bit of kind of working on the other side as client, really. I mean, that was quite an early experience there.
Well, although it was a long, long time ago, I still remember any number of architects coming in and interviewing and the vastly different ways in which architects presented their work, from some that were compelling and successful to some that that you wondered how they stayed in business.
So you talked then about, did you change practice then? Did you, you talked about setting up your own practice?
I continued teaching, but what happened was I was asked by the dean of the business school at Washington U, it's the Olin School of Business, if I would transfer from the architecture school to the business school and become assistant dean of the business school. And so I did that, and I then helped to, the nature of the business school was changing from what had been a traditional school, what was called business and public finance, to a school of business and management, so much more of a management-orientated school. And so they wanted me to help with that. And in a curious way, an architect's training was sufficiently different from the way all the business people were trained that I was able to bring a different perspective on it. And I think that, in later years, I've seen articles in the Harvard Business Review and stuff talking about the importance of this, bringing in the creative side, because it really was different. One of the advantages of it, of course, was that as the only non-business trained person and the only architect in the business school, no one could actually judge whether I was doing a good job or not.
But a real kind of contrast there. I mean, you talk a lot of big businesses, big architecture businesses, talk now about bringing in business kind of the other way around, I guess, kind of professional business people to run the business. And then the story I'm interested in is making the leap, over the road from your practice to
that's right.
To HAK.
Well, I was. It was funny, I was on the top floor of my building, so I had a kind of penthouse in a tiny building compared to HOK, which had a whole floor and a large new office building that they had just designed.
What sort of size at the time?
I would guess the HOK in St. Louis was about 250 people at the time.
And principally just in St. Louis?
Well, by that time, no, because what's interesting is the founders, HO and K, from the very beginning of the practice, had a very strong philosophy that the success and long-term success of the practice would be based in diversity. And so even in mid-century America at the time, they brought together architects, interior designers, landscape architects, urban designers, and graphic designers as well, with the concept that if you had the best professionals doing their part, you would get the best overall design. And that sense of diversity was not just in kind of the different professional roles, but they wanted a diversity also of building types. Yeah. And ultimately, their goal was a diversity of geography and people as well, because George Hellmuth's father, uncle, and grandfather had all been architects, and so he had grown up with the kind of boom and bust cycle of the building industry and the architecture profession following that. And so he was always striving to create as much diversity as possible.
Spreading your business risk amongst.
From the office in St. Louis, the first office outside of St. Louis that they opened was one in San Francisco, so to cover the West Coast, then New York, then Dallas for the South and the Southwest, And so HOK was already, it was very much a national practice at that time. So.
so you were over the road in your penthouse looking down on HOK.
And Guo Bada and John Mann, who was at that time the HR person, I guess, invited me to lunch. And over lunch, they explained that they were setting up a practice in London and that... they had talked among themselves and decided that they would like me to join HOK to move to London. Over lunch, they explained that that there were kind of three things that affected that decision. Mm-hmm. That first of all, it would be a small office, and HOK, and particularly HOK St. Louis, people had become accustomed to working in a big practice, whereas because I was in a practice of 10 people, I had to do everything, and so that would come in handy.
So that was the first thing.
That was the first thing. The first thing. The second thing I said was, we know you've been teaching for years, and by this time I'd actually stopped teaching at Washington U because I'd been offered a visiting. Teaching role at the University of Texas. So I was actually commuting between St. Louis and Texas. And they said, you've been teaching for years, and that where this isn't just, opening up in another American city. We're going to be opening up in a whole new culture, a new continent. And so your teaching ability should help you in kind of introducing people to a new way of doing things. And which, was, again, flattering. Yeah. A little ironic, though, of course, because I hadn't worked at HOK, I had to learn the HOK way of doing things.
Before teaching. Yeah.
And then the third thing Guo said was, this, you're going to be, across the ocean. And so, Guo at the time he'd always been the design director for the whole practice. Right. And he said, I won't be able to keep as close an eye on what you're doing, and therefore I have to have trust that you're going to do the right thing in design terms. And what I've seen from your practice and from the time at the university, I think you're the person for that. Okay. So that's really how it came about. I joined,
you made the decision straight away? Did you go?
I let them send me to London twice.
Had you been to London before?
Actually, I'd never been to London. I'd been to Europe a number of times, but always to the continent.
So you did your due diligence by traveling to London before making a decision.
Yes, and I did. I called a number of the people that I knew, like Neve Brown and. Marius Reynolds, I have to say it seemed like a fantastic offer, and my partner in my practice said, this is a good opportunity, and so what I'll do is we'll have the practice valued, and I'll buy your half of the practice, and if in 3 years' time you want to come back, I'll sell it to you back at the same price. So, there was really no downside to doing it, and a lot of positives.
Yeah. So the move in 87, 85,
End of 88, early 89. Yeah. Okay. Beginning of 89. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you moved to London, just you.
Just me. And.
First job, I guess, find an office. What was the
actually we already had the office had a project. It was St. Enoch Center in Glasgow that had was initially started out of the St. Louis practice, but a couple of people had come over already, and so we had a kind of a very small
team.
In fact, in a building that was it was scheduled to be torn down imminently, so the rent was low, and it was a kind of month-to-month rent until demolition occurred.
Do you remember where that was? Whereabouts?
In yeah, city, it's in High Holborn, in fact, the building's still there today because I guess it was 1990. Yeah. You had the recession.
Yeah, one of the recessions.
So they decided not to demolish it, and in the end, refurbished it and actually put in changed the entrance from one side of the street to the other to make it seem like a new building. And I just saw it yesterday. Yeah. I was going by there and saw it's still there.
You could have, right. But you presumably outgrew the space then, did you? Was that
Well, gradually, you know, we kept growing. And again, our philosophy of practice, which is HOK's, was that every office is meant to be a very strong local practice that then benefits from all the advantages of the kind of alliance and participation in the bigger HOK. So our first client was the Church Commissioners of the Church of England. They were expanding their investment portfolio in real estate, moving more out of traditional bonds and things. Yeah. And they had seen a number of shopping centers that HOK had designed in the States. And so they asked us if we would become the retail designers for St. Enoch Center in Glasgow. And so we joined together with GMW and Riachan Hall, and were the architects for St. Enoch Center. And then in London, again, you know, we wanted very much to find British clients and had the great advantage, I guess, that British Petroleum had a couple of years before acquired Standard Oil of Ohio, who were headquartered in Cleveland. And when British Petroleum bought them, we were just finishing a new corporate headquarters for them. And so so the British leadership the British leadership came from London and moved into this brand new building that they really liked. And so when they decided to do a new London headquarters, they were keen to invite us to see what we, well, really to find out what we would do, and they were pleased. And so that led to are doing the fit out work for BP's headquarters in Britannic House on Finsbury Circus in the city, and it's a fantastic Lutyens building, a listed Lutyens building, and so we were able to really, I mean, it's a good indication of how important context is to us, because so much of the design really came out of our study of Lutyens and trying to kind of think about, well, you know, because how if Lutyens were doing this now, how would he do it? And
you what would Lutyens do?
Exactly, exactly. You know, because it was the Anglo-Persian Oil Company when the building was built. And, you know, but things like the entrance hall, which had been preserved as part of the listing, it was your fairly typical sort of black and white floor, but the white squares are marble, but the black squares are black steel from the hull of one of their first oil tankers.
Wow. Okay.
And that's still there today. And it's, I think, that kind of cultural richness is not just important in terms of the architecture, but it's great when the actual history of the organization, the institution, is symbolized in the building.
Really embedded in the building. Yeah.
Literally embedded. Yeah.
And that, I'm interested then in how kind of culturally different the idea of, you know, you're opening a new office, you have to meet new clients, persuade new clients. Is there a kind of big cultural difference about winning work and how you approach people and how you won work? Really?
I think that the great challenge was establishing the sense that we intended this to be a London and a kind of Anglo-American practice.
Right.
I think there was a strong feeling among many people that you know we would come for a project or two or three and then pack our bags and go home. A lot of people were skeptical because we couldn't prove a local track record. Yeah. They would say, yeah. Well, you know, we like these buildings that we see from the States, but
what have you built here?
What have you done here? Exactly, what have you done here? And so that's really why we worked so hard to find British clients, because we wanted to really establish that. So, you know, soon after British Petroleum, I guess the next milestone project for us was St. Barnabas Church in Dulwich Village, a Church of England church, the existing St. Barnabas on Carlton Avenue, burned down in the early 90s, and it had been a listed church, although Pevsner described it only as a very red brick church. So whilst I think people understandably had a strong, the parishioners had a strong tie and appreciation of the church, in architectural terms, it was one of many red brick churches. But again, there was a tradition there, there was a belief, and so we wanted to do something that would build on that, and ended up developing a design that that was in brick and red brick and slate, like the original church, set back from the street, unlike the original church, and then with a glass spire. And the glass spire was pretty much just glass with stainless steel cables and a very light frame. And that became very contentious with because it was a conservation area. Yeah. But the whole design was about divine light in the sense of the light coming into the church from above, symbolizing a divine presence, with the brick coming up from the ground. There are eight large brick piers that hold everything up, and that's kind of the clay of the people coming up. So,
but a very establishment client, really, and to win that sort of establishment client so early on, quite a coup, but quite a bold, for Church of England commissioners to pick a foreign architect and to, quite a bold decision for them as well.
Actually, and I mean, this was not the church commissioners. In this case, it was the Diocese of Southwark. And so, in a way, they're entirely separate because one was a group of investment people and the other were a group of religious people.
And it was their decision.
Maybe
that's even more of a bold decision by them,
No, indeed, and you know, we were competing against two other practices who had a long track record of, in fact, you know, you would have considered them ecclesiastical architects. So
they were looking for something new, maybe, and something, kind of.
Yes, well, I think you know what we provided was a design that was clearly contemporary and of its time, and yet was wholly inspired by what had come before. In fact, even we retained a portion of the old wall and the foundations, which form the kind of processional way that you, when you go from the street to the church, so you walk through, in effect, the old church to get to the new church.
So that was one of the main, one of the first, when was that? Early 90s, mid-90s?
Yeah, that was 1990, I guess, 94, so we were appointed,
and the practice
93, 94,
And the practice had grown kind of organically until, then.
It has, that's right.
But 95 then, was it 95?
It was, yeah. In 1995, we had kind of weathered the first recession of our time in London, and we were about 45 and 50 people, but we recognized that the majority of our work was commercial work, although we were working on the church, and to be a real, again, to be a real HOK office, we needed to have diversity. And so we began to look among the other practices in London, to look for a practice that that would be a complementary fit to ours, one in which there, you know, that would be kind of more or less the same size we were, but would be doing a different kind of practice. And from looking really at all the practices, at least all that we knew of, we came down to, I guess, a short list of four or five, and put out feelers to them about whether they would be interested in merging, because for us it was more of a merger of two equals, although we had the support behind us. And found eventually a very compatible fit with Cecil Denny Highton, a firm of excellent reputation, but a firm whereas about 80% of our work was commercial, 85% of their work was government and an institutional work, and cultural work as well. So
it, kind of complementary fit.
Exactly. And so the by that time Ray Cecil had passed away, and so there were three senior partners, and they became directors with us in HOK London, and so the directorship increased to, I guess, about 8 or 9 people. And the practice went from each practice was about 50 people, so we became a 100-person practice, which then gave us the scale that would allow us to do the kinds of projects that our American cousins were doing. And within a year or so, between 1995 and 96, we grew to 150. And we'd always described it and really worked hard to keep everyone in both practices, because it's always a challenge
to merge.
But we explained to everyone that this was not a way to contract, but rather this was a merger for expansion. And you know, and there was a lot of skepticism on from some people, because through the early 90s, so many practices had really shrunken and been spinning off people through redundancies, but our vision was that this was a great opportunity for growth for everyone.
Scale, and you've been in this office for
10 years.
100,
we're about 135.
Okay. People sat by, I guess, by projects, but ultimately
We're organized around a central atrium, and everybody has access to that. And in any given day, you'll see a lot of teams working together in that central atrium. The teams are generally organized in the biggest groups are kind of urban design and landscape architecture, interiors, and then the architects. So it's those kind of disciplines are important. But even then, and as often happens, we're just finishing several new university buildings where we're doing the architecture, the landscape, and the interiors, and so that.
Yeah.
All three of those disciplines are sitting together there,
okay.
But otherwise they kind of go back into the discipline pools. But beyond that, we're always looking to how can we really get people to work together. There's only one private office in the whole the whole floor, and that is our HR person. Otherwise, we all sit in the open plan and really find that the best way, that you know, you don't kind of by osmosis, you know what's going on. And yet, even in an open plan like this, where we try communication, there's never enough communication in any organization. And so that's the one thing that that I think, you know, I'm very conscious of, and we don't do it well enough, and we need to keep always working at that.
And we talked a little bit earlier then just about how interesting. People talk about that kind of difficult area, mid-sized practice being a really difficult, you're trying to run big jobs, but if a job gets put on hold, you've got a lot of people working on a project and you've got to find, whereas when you reach that 100, 200 person, it's slightly easier maybe to move people between jobs and have that enough jobs going at the same time that keep that.
Yeah, and what actually what it does is it allows you to do a big project and several smaller practices, or several smaller projects at the same time. And it coincided with another big win for us, which was 40 Grosvenor Place for the Grosvenor estate. Again, another blue chip British establishment client. Where we were competing against titled practices. But Grosvenor, the building that was there, it was called Hobart House. The estate had built it in 1939, or at least it was completed in 1939, and was generally known because it was the headquarters of the coal board. They said we're long-term property holders, and so we're very disappointed that we're having to demolish a building that, you know, we only completed in 1940. So what we want is we want to see your ideas for creating a building that will be truly sustainable in every sense of the word, and that we will not be replacing for generations.
And kind of interesting workplace, kind of novel workplaces have been a bit of a theme running through. I mean, we might come on, or maybe to this building where we are, but also onto the Francis Crick, which I guess a relatively recent building, but for a kind of very unique organization, set of organizations, really.
Absolutely. We did a lot of research there. There was initially four, eventually six different organizations, the three universities plus the Medical Research Council, UK Cancer Research, and of course the Wellcome Trust, coming together and saying we're going to create a whole new institute, and one based not as traditionally on the disciplines of science, but rather on solving the big problems of science and medicine. And so our approach was to recognize that in order to do that, you'd have to create a building that encouraged collaboration. And this has been a theme that we've been developing really for years, because if you go back even to when we were appointed with, under Skanska, in a PFI to redesign and restore the Ministry of Defense main building in Whitehall. There, in a grade one listed building, we moved it from 100% cellular to 95% open plan in order to do that, because it had been a building that was built to, rigidly. In a regimented way to kind of separate and isolate people and give them, a privacy. And that's not how the armed forces work anymore. Right. And we did that in working through English Heritage and preserving and enhancing the main public rooms. But, so it's been a constant theme that people naturally want to work together. And it's also why the idea that technology, even though it allows people to work remotely, it doesn't eliminate the social desire to work together. And the benefits that you get from talking to one another, from finding new ideas through sometimes chance meetings and discussions.
The basis of the Francis Crick, then, of bringing the idea behind the organizations coming together.
Right, exactly. All of them coming together.
So you had a client that was pretty forward-looking and had made
absolutely
that decision.
That's what they were seeking. And this is, as always, you know, the architect's role, I think, is to put form and substance around the ideas and hopes and inspirations of people. Yeah. Because they had a vision, and Sir Paul Nurse, who's the head of the Institute, you know, really believed very strongly that this was possible, yeah, but that the buildings often prevented it. And so you find today the kind of four quadrants, the four neighborhoods of science, as we call them. But really, we used the atriums for two things. It's a big building. It's about 800,000 square feet. And often in big buildings like that, you can easily kind of get lost, yes, in a maze of corridors, and scientific buildings are particularly prone to that. Mm. But we use the atrias to link the building. So I would always describe it as the atriums link the different buildings rather than separate them. Yeah. But what it does is it opens up the building to the four cardinal points. And so wherever you are in the building, you can always look up and immediately orientate yourself. Right. Okay. But yes, you know, all the write-up spaces are open plan. All the vertical circulation is brought into the center of the building, and there are help desks on every floor, so that people, and open staircases right there, so that you not only see people kind of around you, your lab group, but you can see people across the floor, but actually in between floors as well. Right. And that, again, is something that we had pioneered as a concept in the Barclays headquarters at Canary Wharf, where instead of doing a traditional center core tower there, we did a U-shaped floor plan with an offset core and created six five-story high atrias.
In the upper, above ground.
Exactly, yeah. So that people not, and it was column-free space, so that people not only saw one another on their individual floors, yeah, but they could see below and above, and see effectively, you're almost taking an X-ray of the building, yeah, each time, so that people are always seeing the whole rather than just their tiny part of it. Yeah.
And I suppose for big organizations, there's a kind of metaphor maybe in knowing what your role in bigger organizations and
part of the building. You know, it helps, I think, very much in the culture of the organization. It helps people, as you say, understand that they are playing an important role in a much bigger, yeah, in a much bigger performance, yeah, in a way. So, the CRIC also kind of puts science on display, because, mm-hmm, you know, if you go back to the early 20th century, science was seen as a very positive thing that was making people healthier, live, yeah, longer. It was finding all kinds of new positive things. Mm-hmm. And then through the course of two world wars and the nuclear age, yeah, some people became suspicious of science. And, the CRIC, the whole ground floor virtually is open and glazed, and you can see in it has the exhibition center on the ground floor, the large auditorium, the cafeteria is down there, so that people, and there's also a teaching lab for school students to come in, and all of that you can see from the outside, so that you know that this is not a place full of barriers and secrets, but rather something that really
open
celebrates what goes on. Yeah.
Kind of interested in jumping right back, really. You're kind of feeling at home, really, in London, and kind of jumping back to, I mean, when you moved here, you said your business partner talked about coming back in 3 years, maybe, and did you move as, were you expecting to come back? Were you moving? Was this a kind of final,
I'm completing my 30th year. At the end of this year will be 30 years. I certainly originally assumed, it was an assumption, I guess, that I would stay for a few years, I would get the office up and running.
It would be a posting
rather than... Yeah, exactly, and that I would return. I suppose that there's always been new challenges and new opportunities. London is a fantastic place for that. It really is the crossroads of the world in a sense, because so many different cultures through the UK's history of expansion through empire made London one of the perhaps the first world city in that sense, and it has always retained that. So in a kind of a broad sense, that has always been a draw to London, and I think why just in our own office we have 28 different nationalities represented. Wow. Okay. And that's again part of that rich diversity that gives us
diversity.
On a more personal level, when I was designing St. Barnabas Church, a member of the congregation, as she describes it now, she said, first I admired the glass spire, and eventually I thought, well, the architect's pretty good too. So we met and married here in London, and both of our children were born here in London. Right. So, you know, I am yet to claim the title of being a Londoner, but I'm at least accommodated by London and to London.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Larry Malik. You can find out more about Larry and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this really helps others to discover the programme. You've been listening to the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.